Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking now about the history of the Kickapoo Valley Reserve with our guest, Brad Steinmetz. He is a retired teacher, lives in Lafarge, has an active interest in local history. He's written three books, history books, a two-volume history of Lafarge, and a book on the Lafarge Dam Project. And we'll certainly get into that discussion as we move along today. Have you visited the Kickapoo Valley Reserve? Tell us what you liked about it. Questions about it? I hope you'll join in. Do you know the history of the Lafarge Dam Project? Maybe we'll get some callers from that particular area to join in. But you can join in, too. Call us at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Brad Steinmetz, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, good to be here.
For those who haven't been, sort of give us, I sort of said where it was located, but give us the scale here that we're talking about.
Well, the Kickapoo Valley Reserve is actually the largest piece of public land in southern Wisconsin. It's almost 9,000 acres. It's located between Lafarge and Ontario in Vernon County, and is land that was purchased by the federal government back in the 1960s and 1970s for the proposed Lafarge Dam Project. And so some 140 people, families, were moved off their properties, and this was going to be, part of it would have been submerged in a small lake, and others would have been recreation areas around that body of water and that type of thing.
Yeah.
That project, of course, never happened, and the dam was never completed or any of that stuff was done. And eventually the federal government turned the land over to the state of Wisconsin, and the reserve was created in late 1990s. A lot of planning went into it, and the property was finally transitioned from the federal over to the state in late December of 2000. And then that's when the reserve was officially created.
And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, did it have a portion of it too, or part of that agreement?
Yes, it was interesting that when the federal government was going through the process of turning this land over to the state, one of the things they had to do was they had to offer it to any other federal agency. And they didn't get any interest, except the Bureau of Indian Affairs was interested in the land, particularly since the Ho-Chunk Nation had previously lived in this area and had many stories and parts of their oral history that were associated with the Kickapoo Valley. They hadn't had a lot of contact with the area in some time, but this lived on in their story. And so they were very much interested in it. So when that happened, the Corps invited the Corps of Engineers, who owned the land, they invited the elders of the Ho-Chunk Nation to come to the area and take a look at what they had and what was available. And the elders came down and they had these stories, but they really didn't exactly know where some of the places were. And it was interesting how they linked up with former landowners who had owned this land and and started to find some of these places. And I was on one of the walking trips when one of the former landowners, James Daines, and some of the elders from the Ho-Chunk Nation, we were going to go out on the farm where James was raised and his father had owned and actually sold to the federal government. And so we were walking out to go up to a place called Black Hawk Rock, which is a prominent promontory on the in the Kickapoo Valley in that area. And there were some significant Ho-Chunk places there that had been identified in their oral history. And as we were walking up there, James is with the elders from the Ho-Chunk Nation, Rex Wakeall and others at that time. And he said, well, what about this big mound over here? And he points off to his right. And the elders had no idea what he was talking about. And so he said, well, come on. And we walked off to the right and about a quarter mile away, went up into this little grove of trees. And there was this rather massive mound kind of hidden by this little forest. And they really, the Ho-Chunk really were not aware that it was there. And James explained that when the first white settlers came into the area in the 1850s, they unfortunately brought with them lots of diseases that the Native Americans had no way of fighting against. And there was a massive amount of Native Americans who had died during that time. And this was where they had buried a lot of those people. And it was interesting that the white people in the area at that time would actually come up and helped creating the mound and putting the people in that burial mound. So that was really significant to me because here was, it was a place that was going to be very important to the Ho-Chunk Nation. That they really didn't even know about. And so we, after that, then we walked up to Black Hawk Rock and they showed us some petroglyphs in a little cave in that area. And then they started telling us about the significance of that place. They'd held sweat lodges there. It was very, very important site for them. For a variety of reasons, really. And they also pointed out to us something that I was not aware of, was that there was actually a marker tree. And they would take trees, young trees, bend branches, and virtually form arrows out of the branches, which would point toward these sites. And so as we started to learn about that, then we started to have some ideas where some of these other sites were at. In the end, then, the Ho-Chunk chose 1,200 acres of this 9,000. Then it was going to be held in trust for the Ho-Chunk Nation. They didn't want to change anything. They didn't want to develop anything. They wanted to put anything there. They wanted to go along with the reserves basic premise that this land would be preserved and it would be used for recreation, people, you know, hike and that kind of thing, and education. And I can remember one of our first classes that I taught out on the reserve was actually on Ho-Chunk land. And it was a combination of, we were talking about when the Ho-Chunk were there and we actually walked up to Black Hawk Rock to see some of that history. And then the last people, the Munson family, who had owned the farm that had been sold to the federal government, you know, for the dam project. And there were actually some of their relatives there. So we could go through that and tell about the, you know, the different times that people had lived on this land. Yeah. Very interesting.
Very, very interesting. And now, as you look at the reserve, it's the home to more than, I think it's 450 archaeological sites?
Yes, it is. It's a massive number, and part of that is because when the Corps of Engineers was developing the idea of putting this dam in north of Lafarge, one of the first things they did was they contacted the Wisconsin Historical Society, and they said, you know, if we buy all this land up and we take these people off the land that live there now, we do have to know about significant historical sites that may be out there. And so starting in the early 1960s, groups of people from the Wisconsin Historical Society and UW students, archaeology students basically, would come to Lafarge for a month, 6 weeks, and they would basically go out and they would walk this land and they were looking for these sites that potentially might be underwater or have to be moved or whatever kind of thing. And they did that. It was kind of a basic thing. They went and they talked to local people and they said, do you know of any of these kinds of things like shelters and petroglyphs and mounds and all of that kind of thing? And of course, people who had lived in the valley all those years, generations, families going back 100 years, they knew of some of these places. One of the first that the Historical Society went to was a petroglyph called the Hanson Rock Petroglyph. And it was just north of Lafarge. It was a petroglyph that was located on a sandstone wall, basically right above the Kickapoo River. It was a very interesting petroglyph. Although the people from the Historical Society didn't know what it was. And they took photos and they took chalk and they traced in the lines so it would be more visible. I'm not sure you would want to do that today. I don't think that
No.
probably carries over today. But anyway, because they had never seen anything like it. So they go back to Madison and they, you know, they get all the UW people and all of the people in the Historical Society and say, what do we have here? And nobody knew what it was. And so there was an archaeological convention coming up, so they took this to that convention, and immediately some of the people, archaeologists, especially from the West, well, said, these are the people 5,000 years ago who were running around chasing after mastodons or whatever you had, and we didn't realize that they were east of the Mississippi. It was the first time it had ever been seen. And so you had at that point, very early on, the recognition that these people 5,000 years ago were living in the Kickapoo Valley and creating these petroglyphs. And so then that just set off a frenzy for the next decade. And what's interesting about that is that because the dam project was stopped, but then there was this long 20-year delay where nothing happened to the land, the Historical Society could continue coming out every summer and keep looking for more and more of these sites, which, you know, they found. And it was really interesting that this, you cited that number previously about how many of these are on the reserve. It's because of that intense research that was done for 20-30 year period.
Yeah.
It's most places you can't get that because, you know, people are farming it or whatever. And so it's really interesting how that all came up.
Brad Steinmetz, our guest today, author, local historian, retired teacher, lives in Lafarge, and we're talking with him about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. Questions, comments, maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mealer here. We're talking about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. And if you haven't been there, we've thousands of acres in the Kickapoo Valley set aside for you and for me to hike or canoe or fish or hunt or cross-country ski or just observe the nature of that area. It has over 450 archaeological sites. We've been talking about the reserve and zeroing in a bit on those sites with our guest, Brad Steinmetz, author and local historian. Written a lot about Lafarge, that Lafarge area, lives in that area, and it's great to have him with us. Join in. The number's 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@WPR.org. And I also did want to mention just in passing that our next book club selection, a little less than a month away, if you haven't read it yet, grab a copy. It's titled Blue Lake, and the author is Jeffrey Bolt. We'll talk with him on August 22nd, so I hope you can read along on that. In the meantime, give us a call with your questions, comments, or experiences about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Here we were talking about petroglyphs, and these are basically their images carved into the sandstone, right, Brad? And they may be birds or other things as well.
Yes, the Hanson's Rock petroglyph that we were talking about earlier, that was it appeared to be like a mother bird with its wings spread out, and then there were two smaller, like chicks, underneath one of the wings. And the beauty of these is it links us to that time when those people were there. The problem with like that particular petroglyph is it's out in the open and it's on a rather soft sandstone, and so it has deteriorated over the years. And I saw a photo of the petroglyph here about a year or two ago, and it was kind of startling how much it had deteriorated. But at least we have what it did look like, and that type of thing. When we have other petroglyphs that are located inside rock shelters and that type of thing, those, because they're protected from the weather, they have a much better situation of being preserved and kept more or less intact. It's kind of interesting, when all of these sites were being found in the Upper Kickapoo Valley, these historic sites, prehistoric sites, it brought in a lot of archaeologists and people of that sort to find these places. And as Kickapoojans are wont to do, someone, says, well, I got a really nice petroglyph on my place. And somebody says, oh, I got a better one over here on mine. And, well, as it turned out, there was an amazing cave, not in the Kickapoo Valley, but over on the western branch of the Kickapoo, not very far away, that had amazing petroglyphs in it. And one day I was in the Rockton Bar having lunch, and the owner of the bar, Dean Hamilton, goes, hey, he says, you're a history guy. You ought to go talk to those guys over at that table. I said, why? He said, well, they're here about the Native American petroglyphs and all that kind of stuff. So I walked over, and then he went to the table and told him who I was. And so we kind of got together. And so they started describing this amazing cave with these variety of petroglyphs. And that cave is unique in that it shows different age in times when Native Americans were in that structure and making those petroglyphs. So it's just an amazing find. And eventually the University of Wisconsin La Crosse Archaeological Center took it over. And I was actually able to go to the site and see it. It's really quite amazing. But again, that comes from all of that research that was done because of the delay in the dam project and what are we going to do with this land and all of that kind of thing, which just kept this research continuing and led to these amazing discoveries.
Yeah. What years or time periods, I guess we should say, did the all of the sites go back to? It goes back 10,000 years, doesn't it?
It does. And you know, that Hansen's Rock petroglyph placed people in the Kickapoo Valley 5,000 years ago. And then, you know, we have further evidence that there were people, you know, before that. And so you can just kind of go through every one of those ages, and you have those different groups that were in there. We know, for instance, that, you know, you're probably familiar with the Boaz mastodon, which is actually on the UW campus. And that was found in 1897 in a little town called Boaz between Richardson Center and Reachdown, just off the Kickapoo Valley a little ways. And the mastodon was found, and there was a spear point in the rib cage of that animal, which indicated that the people killed it, probably for food. And it also indicated, you know, we knew the mastodons were, we didn't know the people were there, but that was found. And the Boaz mastodon, interesting story. The owners of the land kept the mastodon and then basically rented it out to a circus, which ran around the whole state and Midwest showing this mastodon off. And then finally there was a curator at the Historical Society, which was just getting going big time. And they're going, oh, my God, you can't have this out there where people, you know, you got to, you know, save this kind of thing. So he got them to donate it to the university. And so it's been kept. It used to be in the front hall of the archaeology center there. I'm not sure. I think it's been moved since then. But that shows, you know, that finding with that Clovis point, spear point that was in its ribcage. It, you know, said, hey, there were people here, you know, 10,000 years ago, which is how you come up with that information.
Well, I want to focus on, there's so many, there's several different types of sites, and we've zeroed in a lot on petroglyphs, but there are, and I think you mentioned rock shelters in passing and burial mounds. Let's focus on those rock shelters for a few minutes. What do those look like, those rock shelters?
Well, they're different, and it's interesting is that very close to the visitor center at the reserve, you know, for you can walk for 5 minutes and you can loop around a little rock cliff there, and there's a small shelter that was used, and it's interesting that when the reserve is created, they were saying, well, they used to, you know, actually live in this shelter. And so there were two young men who decided they would go deer hunting, and they were going to live in that shelter to see if they could stay overnight and in the winter of Wisconsin and go deer hunting and all that kind of, and they did. And it was really an interesting concept. But then you have other rock shelters that are as large as a 2 or 3 room apartment where, you know, dozens of people could stay. And there's one in particular on the reserve that is very, very difficult to get to. It has a marker tree that shows you how to get there, but it's quite a little trek to get down to it. And it's really very much hidden, which is good because you don't want everybody going into it. And so when you get to that, you can understand, well, yes, the people could winter over in this climate with that kind of a shelter. And you can actually see one of the rooms, all of the the sandstone walls are black because they had the fire in that room and the smoke and that kind of thing. And they'd actually kind of poked a hole up through once at the top so the smoke could get out. But still, you know, that was the room where the fire was always held and that kind of thing. So they are really kind of amazing to show that those people, you know, from the Ho-Chunk, the last group that was there, to others before them, could stay in the climate during those times.
Would those rock shelters tell us about the early people's diets?
I imagine they would. You know, another thing is that the people who lived here in the Kickapoo Valley, they used the plants that were in the Kickapoo Valley. They hunted the animals that were in the Kickapoo Valley. They fished for the fish that were in the Kickapoo Valley. And that, you know, that was their diet. And an interesting story that I have from my family history was my grandmother, who was a young girl in the 1890s, and she lived up on a farm on a ridge between Lafarge and Viroqua. And at that time, what were known as the Winnebago then, but who are the Ho-Chunk, were living out in Iowa. But they wanted to come back to the Kickapoo Valley in the summertime, mainly to harvest plants, which they used for medicines and their diets. And so they would walk and have wagons travel back from Iowa to the Kickapoo Valley. And my great-grandmother was a really good baker. And she made great bread and rolls and pies and all that kind of thing. And the Native Americans would always stop at the farm to see what she was baking. And then they would trade her maple syrup and maple sugar candy, which they had done during the maple syrup season, which had been a little earlier. And of course the kids were always in the family were always, yes, yes, they're here with the candy, you know, type of thing, which my grandmother could remember. And they would make that trade. And then those people would come down into the Kickapoo Valley. They would camp in the valley at different spots and very traditional spots where they had camped before. And then they would go out and they would harvest these plants, mainly medicinal plants. They made poultices out of them and all kinds of things. And then at the end of the summer, in a place called Kickapoo Center, which is between Viola and Reedstown in the Kickapoo Valley, they would have a rally, and they would invite everybody in, and they would... the Ho-Chunk would get the drums out and they would do the dancing and they would sell their products. And the people would come and really enjoy it. And then they'd pack everything up and they would head back to Iowa for the winter because they couldn't stay in the valley without permanent structures, which they couldn't build. And they had to go back to Iowa because the federal government had a yearly stipend or money they gave them, and they had to be back there to get that. But it's really interesting. There was in my study of Lafarge history that I've done, there was a doctor who lived in very early Lafarge, even before it was incorporated. And he used a lot of these traditional remedies of the Native Americans. And they would always stop at his office there at a place called Seelyburg, which is the original Lafarge. And then at the end of the summer, then he would buy these items from the Native Americans for his own practice. And then they would head back to Iowa. So it's really interesting how that tradition of those remedies and medicines and things that the Ho-Chunk had moved over into the settlers' community and were used and very, very well accepted.
Kind of reminds me back to my earlier guest, Anton Troyer, and talking about how the different cultures, as we were talking about languages, and he was saying we need to preserve languages in part because of the information that would be lost without having that culture represented in its language. And I think here's an example right there of one sort of culture passing on to another some really important information.
Yes, yes, that is truly important. And as he was relating that, I was thinking about one time I was teaching a class in the reserve in the summertime. It was high school students. And the Ho-Chunk on one of their parcels of their trust land had a summer immersion camp for their high school age kids. And they would bring them down from Black River Fall, Toma, different areas. And they would camp out in this area. And they would have the elders there using the language and teaching the students the language. They would have the students make a chikotapoy, which is like a wigwam that the Ho-Chunk made. They would actually have the students create this big wigwam area where they would stay. And it was really, really interesting. And one year when I had the class, we went out there for a day. While we were there, it was so interesting because my students from my class, they wanted to know these words that the Ho-Chunk students were using. And so they would give them a word, and then the Ho-Chunk would say the word back to them in their language. And it was really an interesting process. And then they got into talking about, well, how do you make this thing? And how do you get the branches to bend so it's round? You know, all that kind of thing. It was very, very interesting process. And I really, really hated it when the Ho-Chunk quit their immersion class, because that was a very, very interesting time to visit with them.
Brad Steinmetz, our guest today. Brad Steinmetz, an author, local historian, retired teacher, lives in Lafarge. It's great to have him with us to talk today about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve and its history. Questions, comments, experience, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Larry Mueller here for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today as we talk with Brad Steinmetz, author, local historian, retired teacher. It's great to have him with us to talk about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. And again, you can join in with your own questions or comments or maybe an experience to share at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And a quick reminder, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we've got an extension educator checking in on how your plants are doing. And we are looking forward to that as well on tomorrow's program. But right now, we're on to the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. I wanted to go back to the mounds. We mentioned the burial mounds a time or two. I think there were three types. There was a conical type, there was an oval type, and there was a linear type. We at all three, I think, are present at some point. You can see them in the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. Was there a reason, or do we know, have any idea as to why we had these different forms or shapes for the burial mounds?
It probably indicates different peoples. And, you know, you have a particular time when the mounds were used for specific identification of the people that were living there. And interestingly enough, the mounds, the greatest amount of mounds that were in the Kickapoo Valley were in the southern part of the village of Viola at a place called Mound Park. And this was an area that had the most mounds of any place in the Kickapoo Valley. And it included the dome mounds, and it included the linear mounds. And it had actually an effigy mound there as well of a, I think it was an animal. And unfortunately, they were all plowed up, farming residences were built over them, all of that type of thing. And they were pretty much lost. But that particular site indicated generations of, or really ages of people, you know, from the different ages that you had in the Kickapoo Valley, of people living there and the types of mounds that they use. Now, another thing that when the Historical Society archaeologists were out and they were looking at mounds, one of the things they found was that they had mounds that would have to be moved because there was going to be new roads built and all of this type of thing. And then so they took a look at the mounds. Do they have artifacts in them? Do they have human remains in them? That type of thing. And I believe there were three actually north of Lafarge that were excavated, and the remains were shipped down to Madison. They're kept at the Historical Society. But that indicates, you know, that some were burial mounds, and it just shows the vast time differences of the people who lived in the valley and what they used the mounds for.
Absolutely amazing. We've talked a bit about the Lafarge Dam project, but you've written a history of that, and actually I can almost think I experienced a whole lot of that as part of my job here. I talked about the Lafarge Dam project on the air back a long time back. But how did this all begin? The purpose had to do in part with flooding issues.
Yes. Yeah, it was, and it's immense history, but it actually started in 1935. There was a massive Kickapoo River flood, and the flood, and there was a railroad that actually ran from Waseca down on the, you know, by the Wisconsin River all the way up to Lafarge. And the flood damaged that railroad really bad, and it was a mainstay for the village of Lafarge. The mail came in on that railroad, the products came in, the products were shipped out, all that kind of thing. So they really needed that railroad protected. So the leaders of Lafarge went to Washington, D.C. and said, can you help us with this flooding problem that we have? Now, the reason that Washington, D.C. knew about it was that there was a reporter that came out from Milwaukee, and he hired a guy who had an airplane over in Hillsboro, not too far from Lafarge, and they went up and they took pictures of the floods as it hit the villages in the Kickapoo Valley, and they were very, very dramatic. The one that showed Lafarge, which was like two-thirds underwater, ended up on the front page of the Milwaukee Journal. And then the wire services picked it up and it went national, basically. And so by the time that those Lafarge leaders got to Washington, D.C., this was New Deal time, you know, for FDR. So we want to get these programs out to the people. And they said, yeah, we'll come and look at it. So the Department of the Interior and the Corps of Engineers, which is part of the Army at that time, they came out and they started looking at it, and so that's how the idea of the dam project came along. It took them a long time to finally get there, which happened in 1962 when the very first bill was passed authorizing a dam project at Lafarge. And so, you know, when that started, then this whole process went along, and they were going to offer flood protection with that dam, and then they were also going to build dikes around the villages of Soldiers Grove and Gage Mills on the southern end of the valley to protect those areas. And eventually the project was stopped, and I don't, you know, economic and...
Well, they bought out, they bought the farms. A lot of people didn't want to sell.
Yeah, right. They were building the dam, and they were buying out the farms at the same time as it looked like they might be stopping the project. So, you know, people were going, well, we don't want to sell our farm because it's never going to happen, the type of thing. But you don't have much, you don't have any way to fight that. The federal government has an authorized project, and they can do that using power of public domain to take the land away. I mean, they pay for it, but yeah, it was very hard. And, you know, there was like about 18 of the owners took it to court and said, no, we're not going to sell. And it goes to the circuit court in Madison, and Judge Doyle, the father of the Governor Doyle, he says, no, it's a federal project. They're authorized to do it, and everybody lost. And so, you know, you get your check in the mail or whatever. But it was, it was a very tumultuous time. And then, of course, when they stopped the project, those former landowners wanted their land back. Well, they couldn't get it back, and they sued to get it back, and that didn't work either. And so it was just one thing after another. And then the land sat out here for 20-some years. Corps had it, but nothing was happening. And then, of course, everybody in the area just basically used the land for whatever they wanted. And it was not such good things. Marijuana fields cropped up everywhere. mud bogging with trucks and all of that kind of thing. And so it was just a kind of a circus. And then finally, in the early 1990s, Governor Tommy Thompson and then State Senator Brian Rood put this idea together to what can we do with this land? And they came up with the idea of, well, they didn't come up with it, but they formed a committee and they came up with the idea of creating this reserve, preserving the land, and everybody could enjoy it, type of thing.
Yeah, amazing. It took a long, long time. Oh, you know, there's still got to be some resentment.
Yeah, there is. And you know, in teaching students at Lafarge, I virtually couldn't teach about the controversy because the board was all pro dam, and if I, you know, said, well, who are, you know, what are the sides of the anti-dam? And I mean, I was virtually forced to stop teaching it, or I would lose my job. And so it was funny, years later, you know, 25 years later, I'm teaching a course for adults out at the reserve, and one of my former students is in the class, and she said, well, you wouldn't teach us when we were in high school. So I have to come now and find out what this history of the reserve and the project, you know. So, yeah, it was just a time of protest and you know, pro-dam versus anti-dam, and all of this kind of thing was going on. So it's very tumultuous.
Matthew in Mazamani has a question for you, or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. I just wanted to address the Kickapoo term. And as I understand it, this is an Algonquin-based word, like most Wisconsin native place names. And I know that the tribe that eventually became the Kickapoo tribe started maybe down in Ohio and would have wandered up under various pressures and ended up in the Kickapoo River area at some point, and then now we're down maybe towards Oklahoma. But I wondered, is this similar to, say, the Sioux Indian tribe where other tribes name them? But it's not what they call themselves. Did they get the name from the river, which had already been previously named for its meandering character? To what extent, you know, does this tribe start with a name or have it applied because either they wander around or because they end up by the Kickapoo, which has already been named?
Well, it is interesting in that those people were in the in that valley, in the Kickapoo Valley at that time, when the French first came and were trading for furs and that kind of thing, and created this kind of a trading relationship with the people of Western Wisconsin. And that adaptation of the French name for the people became Kickapoo. And that's really how the name Kickapoo is formed. Actually, you know, as many of those nations' names were changed, most of them were picked up, like the Ho-Chunk became the Winnebago, through English type of transitions, whereas with this one, it's actually the French pronunciation of that group of people. And it does have to do with their wandering. It does have to do with it. And the meandering nature of the river and all of that, I'm sure it's part of it, but it's an interesting idea. And it's very interesting that you mentioned the Kickapoo, because when the reserve was started, the Ho-Chunk Nation reached out to that group of people down in Oklahoma and some are down in Texas, and said, "Now we don't want to do anything to, you know, leave you out of this. So are you interested in, you know, what we're doing here?" And they sent representatives up to the area, the Kickapoo did, and those people did, and were very, very interested in preserving the land and that type of thing. So they did become involved in that respect. They backed the Ho-Chunk in what they were doing.
Matthew, thanks again. Appreciate it. Are scientists, archaeologists, are they still working over there or studying in the reserve at all, from what you know?
I would say yes. I think it's a place that is so unique, and it is loaded with places that's still going on. It's kind of interesting. There's a big tree planting project that's going on in the reserve right now on one of the areas that has just been kind of opened up, and they're replanting rather mature oaks back into an area that would have had them before farming came along. And as they're going up through there, then they have to bring archaeologists in to see if there's anything there before they plant the trees. And wouldn't you know it, they found something. And so that tree planting has been put on hold a little bit while they make sure that they're not, you know, messing something else up from an age before, you know, type of thing. So yeah, it goes on.
Will you be teaching any more classes at the reserve?
I generally talk to adult groups now. I used to hike with the kids all the time, but I did have one group of children, school children, this spring that I talked to. But when the adult groups come along, I generally do talk to them. And I've had a couple of those that have stopped in, I've talked to in the last month or so.
Okay, but you don't have a schedule of...
No, I don't. We don't have a scheduled class anymore like we used to. But that was fun.
Speaking of fun, it's been fun talking with you, Brad. This has been really enjoyable. I appreciate it very much. I hope we get a chance to talk again. Thank you so much.
That'd be great. Thank you, Larry.
Brad Steinmetz, author, local historian. Excuse me. It was really fun talking with him about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. And thank you so much for listening. It's always a lot of fun. And as always, our shows are a team effort. We've got our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, our technical directors, our Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. We have a lot of fun putting this show on. We enjoy it a lot, and I hope you enjoy it too. We'll be back tomorrow for Garden Talk. Stay with us, though, for WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.